It's not just the water. Welcome to The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. And after the public health crisis in Flint, Michigan, and the news about lead showing up in Tacoma, when you hear lead, you probably think water. Should I be running my tap? Are my kids at risk if they're drinking the water at home or at school? Well, the good news is kids have a very low chance of getting lead poisoning in Washington state. But Seattle Times health reporter Jonelle Alicia says, if you want to protect your kids from lead exposure, you need to think about more than your water.
The water isn't the problem, from what health officials tell me. Instead, the real sources of lead that cause problems in our area, potentially, are lead paint in old houses, lead tracked home from a parent's job, for instance, a parent who works in construction and is exposed to lead during work, and lead from other sources, including things like hobbies or even cultural practices, cosmetics, or kind of lead-based healing remedies.
You said that in our area, these are the things we should be thinking about, but in Tacoma, the city has been testing their water for lead. There have been findings of lead in schools and homes, the water that people are drinking there. So does this list of things to look at in terms of lead exposure, does this go for Tacoma as well?
Well, I looked at the lead exposure in kids throughout Washington state. And for last year, of 20,000 tests submitted to the State Department of Health, there were only 365 kids under age 6 who had lead levels high enough to potentially worry about. And only a fraction of those kids had levels that even would warrant, for instance, a home visit by health officials to see what the problem was. So really, we have not had a lot of concern about lead poisoning in our state.
As you just pointed out, you looked at lead exposure in kids. So why are kids most at risk when it comes to lead exposure?
Well, what health officials tell me is that in very young children, the blood-brain barrier isn't formed yet or sealed yet, and so the lead has much more of a potential of kind of leaching into their brains and causing problems, including mental health problems, you know, like drops in IQ, and even physical problems. And because they're so little, they are just far more vulnerable than older kids and adults.
So, Jonelle, I have a 3.5-year-old. So as I'm thinking about protecting her from lead exposure, what should I be doing to protect her?
Well, you and other parents should look closely at your environment. People who live in older houses, houses built before 1950 or houses built before 1978 that have been recently renovated, are where the highest risks are, primarily from old lead-based paints. And also look closely at any potential sources of lead in the environment.
Jonelle, one of the other things you reported is that the state of Washington is looking at changing its approach to testing children for lead. They're thinking about doing it less often and only for those children who are deemed high risk for lead exposure. Why is that the case?
Well, these are state officials who oversee the Medicaid program that provides health care for low-income and disabled families, of course. And what they're saying is they are actually going along with recent recommendations from the CDC that say that targeted lead screening is much more effective than simply screening all kids. The rules now require kids ages 1 and 2 who are covered by Medicaid to be screened for lead poisoning. And they're saying that it makes much more sense to target those kids who have higher risk of exposure. Low income alone is not a risk factor for lead poisoning the way it once was. It has to be in conjunction with these other risks, like living in these old houses, for instance.
Should I be thinking about getting my daughter tested on my own? Should parents get their children tested on their own for lead?
If parents have a reason to be concerned about potential lead exposure, they can certainly ask their healthcare providers. But the health officials tell me that there's no reason to universally screen children for lead exposure. The most important thing to do is to screen those who are most likely exposed to these kind of potent sources of lead. But what, for instance, Jeff Duchin, the health officer in King County, tells us is that it's not the water that's the risk here.
That's Seattle Times health reporter Jonelle Alicia. Health officials say in Washington state, the highest risks of lead exposure are not from tap water. Old lead paint and lead exposure at work are some of the biggest risks. As you heard in our newscast, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee issued a directive today telling the State Department of Health to help reduce lead exposure. The State Department of Health aims to remove all lead service lines and lead components in the public water system within 15 years. Most people think of the jungle as one big, scary homeless camp under I-5, but really it's more complicated than that. It's more like a collection of neighborhoods. There's danger for sure, yet some people stay in the jungle for years. It's hard for people outside to understand why. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols takes us there.
At the south part of the jungle, the freeway is high overhead. The tents are far below, hidden in the ivy. In the day, there's a spectacular view over Georgetown. But now it's night.
All right, Saturday, 10:35 p.m. Robert and Carmen, I'm just getting off the bus. I'm coming. We get off the bus, going to the jungle. We usually try to be home before it's dark, because it's not the best walk.
Robert and Carmen Patterson have been keeping an audio diary for us. They sent us this entry after a long day doing laundry at their daughter's apartment in Lake Forest Park. They didn't mean to come back so late.
We should come prepared. I got what I call a mini machete. Carmen's got some items. As long as we have our lights. And we know most people around here, so not too bit of a problem. But you never know about the crazies.
Like this one guy who tried to kill them both as they slept. That guy's in jail now. Most of the people here don't exactly have spotless criminal records. Many are addicted to heroin. Near the Patterson's tent, people live in piles of garbage and used syringes. But the Patterson's campsite is relatively clean. They're on the methadone program at a nearby clinic. There are other couples like that nearby. As we head north, we pass people sleeping in blankets on the ground. Those are the new arrivals. We also pass people who've been here longer, who've built plywood walls around their tents. This is the middle jungle, near the Rainier Brewery. Here, the freeway is about 10 feet overhead, so it's darker.
My name is Majok Lewis. And I'm from South Sudan.
Lewis's parents sent him to the U.S. from South Sudan when he was 13. Lewis hasn't seen his parents since then.
I didn't have nobody to help me. And I was just walking down the street downtown. And I find one South Sudanese person guy. And he just told me, "Oh, you can come and live with me in the jungle since you don't have nowhere to go."
Lewis says he lost his identification, so he can't drive, he can't get a job or a place to live.
So I'm stuck down here.
Lewis has watched his friends in the jungle turn bitter. They include former child soldiers from South Sudan, as well as other immigrants.
I can tell you one thing. They just hate the whole Seattle. They hate the whole Seattle. Because the situation that they are in it, that nobody is helping them. Even though you talk, it won't help that much.
What's your hope for the future?
My hope for the future is very big. I want to be able to support myself. And I love my mom so much, and I love my family so much. I want them to see me again.
A muddy trail under the freeway carries us to the North Jungle. Rain forms little rivers, forcing us to jump across. We stop at a spot called the Caves, where five people were shot in January. Here, the freeway is so close, cars bang against the expansion joints overhead. Two people died in the shooting. It happened just feet from Danny's tent.
We have to be very careful about who we see coming up that trail, because sometimes it's not good news. You know, sometimes it's the police. Sometimes it's somebody coming to do something bad.
Danny doesn't give his last name because his family doesn't know he's homeless.
We have sentries up here. We have people standing out here that are looking. And they call one up from the bottom, one from the west. And unfortunately, that didn't work for us that night because the people came up looking like ordinary citizens, and then they just pulled out a gun and started shooting. Nothing we could do.
Kara Bernstein lives in the tent next to Danny. She knows there's danger here. And yet, at the same time, she says she feels safe. This is the paradox of the jungle.
I think for most of us, by the time we've gotten here to the point where we're living under a bridge in tents, we feel very much alone and kind of a displacement and a separation from society. And when you're on the streets, there's absolutely no normalcy at all. There's no routine. And so when I found this place, it had been so long since I felt safe and welcomed.
Bernstein and Danny say the danger in the jungle comes from outsiders. And there's some evidence to support that. Craig Thompson lives in a house about a block from the jungle on Beacon Hill. He says he's seen dealers drive up to the edge of the jungle to sell drugs. Thompson and an army of volunteers have spent countless hours driving them out by gardening. The drug dealers don't like it when there's people around.
It can only be so tough when there's 30 young people who are eager to pull weeds around you.
Thompson and his neighbors have found weapons here in the forest next to I-5. Guns and knives, homemade spears and crossbows. The weapons and the people Thompson has met reveal something about the jungle. Thompson tells the story of a man who set out a hammock here and then claimed to own this piece of the jungle under the Homestead Act. That's the law that once allowed pioneers to claim land here.
Then he looked at me and said, "Here, let me show you what I've got in my pack." He opens up his backpack and pulls out what must have been a ream of legal papers, okay? And he starts flipping through them and he says, "You know what really bothers me now is that I file these papers and the judges won't even let me set foot in court anymore."
Just like back in pioneer days, the man's claim is rooted in the false sense that this land is abandoned. The land is owned by the state. It runs through the city, and it's also claimed as home by hundreds of people. In the jungle, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
We'd love to hear what you think should happen to the jungle. Call our listener feedback line with your thoughts, 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663. This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel. You're with The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Ballots go out at the end of the week for this year's presidential primary in Washington state. Now, Democrats have already made their decision in caucuses earlier this year, but Republicans here have a real choice to make. Their vote will decide how the state's 44 GOP delegates will be apportioned. And at this point, it's not easy to get a feel for which way the vote will go. KUOW's Deborah Wong reports.
There hasn't yet been a poll of likely Republican primary voters in Washington state, so we conducted our own highly unscientific survey standing outside a shopping mall in Bellevue. A lot of people told us they haven't been paying attention or they haven't yet made up their minds, and many seem pretty disenchanted with the choices this year.
I dislike all of them pretty much equally at this point.
But among the Republicans who did have an opinion, we found an exactly equal showing of support for the three candidates, although with differing levels of enthusiasm for each.
Probably for the primaries, I'm leaning towards Kasich, but I haven't decided yet.
Ted Cruz?
Yep, all the way.
Kasich? At this point, I think so, yes. Even though they say he hasn't got a chance.
Donald Trump is the guy. He's a real deal. What you see is what you get.
I'll probably vote for Ted Cruz, but I just really don't like anyone. So it's best of the worst for me, I guess.
That was Johnny Lynn, Kirsten Tuohy, Diane and Jim, who didn't want to give their last names, and Sidoni Washington. So much attention is being paid to the caucuses and primaries that precede Washington state that it's hard to see any evidence of campaigning here. But the campaigns say they're working hard behind the scenes. State Senator Doug Erickson is Donald Trump's deputy director for field operations.
Well, in Washington State, we're very aggressively recruiting volunteers. We are contacting potential voters. We're working on opportunities for Donald Trump to come to Washington State in a series of rallies. Polling numbers nationwide are definitely going up for Donald Trump in the Republican primary, and we hope that spills over into Washington State here.
But in some ways, the Trump campaign is playing catch-up in this state. Ted Cruz has had an organization up and running here for almost a year. It's being managed by a lawyer named Saul Gammerin, who's never before run a presidential campaign.
Never. This is a first for me.
Gammerin says at least in the early days, it was tough to find Cruz supporters among what he calls the usual suspects of the state Republican Party. But since then, the campaign has built what Gammerin calls a broad coalition in support of Cruz.
Look, I'm not a Tea Partier, and I'm not a Christian conservative. We have plenty of Tea Partiers and plenty of Christian conservatives, but we have a lot of other constitutionalists, libertarians, even moderates that believe that now is the time for Ted Cruz.
Cruz has raised the most money of the three GOP candidates in the state. And Gammerin says the campaign has been successful at making sure many of the delegates elected at caucuses here are loyal to Ted Cruz. That will matter if Donald Trump doesn't win the nomination on the first ballot at the national convention. Then delegates will be free to vote as they wish. Gammerin is confident that because of their early organizing, many of this state's delegates will be diehard Cruz supporters. And that brings us to the last Republican candidate. John Kasich has amassed the most impressive collection of endorsements from state GOP leaders, including former Governor Dan Evans and former Attorney General Rob McKenna. Former Secretary of State Sam Reed says Kasich should have a lot of appeal in Washington State, where moderate Republicans tend to win statewide. As the GOP convention approaches, Reed says he's hoping Kasich's appeal will grow.
In my experience, what happens is people get a little more serious about getting somebody who's actually qualified and also somebody who actually can win, as opposed to the gut reaction, I like what that person said. I really feel good about that, which tends to happen early on.
But Reed admits that Kasich doesn't have much of a ground game right now in the state, but that could change as the primary approaches. All three candidates are planning to campaign in the state sometime before ballots are due on May 24th. I'm Deborah Wong, KUOW News.
Artificial intelligence is more common than you might think. Take, for example, virtual assistants. There is Microsoft's Cortana.
I am your personal assistant. I try to make things easier to do on your phone.
And Amazon's Alexa.
I can play music, answer questions, get the news and weather, create to-do lists, and much more.
And then there's Siri, who lives in your iPhone. Siri, why do virtual assistants like you typically have voices that sound female?
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
That's what I figured.
Siri, that doesn't make any sense.
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, well, Siri may not have the answer, but Monica Nicholsberg has been looking into it. She's a writer and web producer for the tech news website GeekWire.
One of the reasons that a lot of these personalities tend to skew female is that they tend to perform functions that have traditionally been done by women. Assistant roles, scheduling meetings, communicating, which is, you know, hugely ascribed as a female strength. So I think that because we sort of have an expectation that that's what the role that they're going to serve in our lives, it's a very natural jump for those organizations to then build female personalities.
But in your writing, you also looked at the idea of user comfort when it came to hearing female voices when you're using virtual assistants. So what did you find out about that?
This is probably what the experts would say is the main reason that these personalities tend to skew female. It's really about user adoption, because that's the end game for them. You know, it's about business, and you want people to use your technology. And we as users often have a little bit more comfort with a female voice, you know, especially if it's a disembodied technology we're not familiar with. It can be a little bit scary. And so having a personality that you have associations with, nurturing, communication, it just makes it, I think, a little bit easier for some people.
So then what concerns do you have about the fact that female voices in AI are so prevalent right now?
I have a concern that we have such an easy time equating human-like with female, you know, sort of less than human, but almost there. And I also just think that we need to really examine these things. You know, technology and innovation moves at such a breakneck pace that we often are adopting it before we really take the time to understand it and what it means for us as, you know, humanity as a whole.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention your writing about sex and female artificial intelligence, too. What's the connection you found there?
So I think it's hard to have a conversation about gender without having a conversation about sex. And I'm really interested in this sort of intersection between technology and gender and sex. I would not go so far as to say there's a direct parallel, but I do think that it's worth examining why we so frequently equate AI personalities and robotics with female, and that there is a very large market for female machine companionship. And there are companies and manufacturers, particularly in Japan, that are already making really big strides to fill that demand.
Are there male-sounding AI robots being developed for sex, or is this just mostly female?
Not really. They're pretty few and far between. For the most part, they are, whether it's sex dolls or there's a lot going on with virtual reality and simulating kind of sex. It's about as close as you can get to having sex with a video game. but I think the demand for that largely comes from men, heterosexual men interested in female technology.
Well, as you've looked at all of this, what's been most surprising to you about AI technology? What did you learn that surprised you the most?
What's most surprising, or I would say interesting, is just how far along this technology is. You know, because it's not brought to market, it's not something that we necessarily are exposed to unless we're really digging, but you can really fall into some Google holes when it comes to advances in robotics and AI, and then, you know, the offshoot of that is in sort of like sexualized and feminized machines that have, you know, personalities, and, you know, they can follow a script but also go off book. It's like you're really interacting with an intelligent being. And so it's just really amazing to see how far they've come.
You can read Monica Nicholsberg at the tech news site GeekWire. We're tweeting out a link to her article right now at KUOW. And now, another question Siri probably can't answer. Is cheerleading just about looks? That question came up after the University of Washington Cheer Squad tried to give some advice last week. The squad produced an image with a young blonde woman modeling their look and listed tips for girls who wanted to try out. The image said things like, do use flattering eyeshadow and maybe false lashes, but don't wear dark, smoky eyes or nude lips. Do have a natural or spray tan, but don't have jewelry, visible tattoos, or distracting nail polish. For some people, this image reinforced negative stereotypes about cheerleaders. I'm appalled that the University of Washington would imply that cheerleading is all about looks and not an impartial contest of athletic prowess, said one person on Reddit. Others called the image offensive, exclusionary, and ignorant, and national media covered the story. In response, the UW asked the team to pull it down, saying it was, quote, inconsistent with the values of the UW Spirit Program and Department of Athletics, end quote. So, story over. Except that at Washington State University in Pullman, the cheer squad has a very similar graphic, almost the same thing, and theirs is still up. Chris Opheim is their coach. He told me they haven't taken it down because that's what their cheer squad looks like.
The picture that we used for our cheerleading look is a picture from a girl cheering on the sideline at a game that we just cropped her out of the background and inserted the other things. So that's why we're kind of standing by it.
Well, for people who haven't seen this graphic that you have for people who want to try out for the cheerleading squad, what does it say? What does it say about what the look is for a cheerleader?
Well, in the world of cheerleading, there's lots of looks. In competitive cheerleading, there's a lot of glitter. In the world of high school cheer, there isn't as much. And in the world of college cheer, there's a certain look as well. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to help out these high school cheerleaders, these all-star competitive cheerleaders, you're trying to help them out to know, you know, what the look of college cheerleading is, and specifically more so what the look of WSU cheerleading is. So the look of college cheerleading at WSU is what we listed out. When we say that natural eyeshadow and that natural blush and everything like that, that's to let kids know that it's not stage makeup, it's not glitter, and it's not all of that stuff. With the hair, you know, the reason why the hair is half up is because when we do our skills and we do the athletic abilities, you want the hair out of the face. That way the kids can focus on what they're doing. You know, at the high school level, they have hair rules that they have about hair being out of the face and all the way up in a ponytail. At the college level, you're saying that we're a little bit more advanced in our skills and our abilities, and that we can handle having hair half up, half down. So that's kind of look at WSU, is that we say that natural blush, that natural eyeshadow, and hair half up and half down.
I think on the graphic it also says clear nail polish, crimson lipstick, as I recall. Are these suggestions, or if I wanted to try out for the squad, leaving aside the fact that I am not young enough to try out for the squad, if I wanted to try out for the squad, is this the way that I have to look to make it?
We're taking what we look like on game day. And what we're trying to find is what you will look like on game day for us. So the crimson lipstick, crimson is one of our school colors, crimson and gray, WSU. The clear nail polish is to, you know, you have girls that are coming from proms sometimes that are you know, are getting ready for other events. School colors, you know, when you're at college, the amount of backing that colleges receive, you know, at WSU, man, we hate the color purple. And I'm sure at University of Washington, just as, you know, you hate the colors crimson and gray just as much. So that's why we set in these, you know, no nail colors, is because it's just one of those school pride things more so than anything else. And if you get rid of those things, everybody's on the same page then. Going into tryouts, everybody's starting at the same level. So therefore, when you get to the skills and abilities, that's what you're judging.
One of the things that's also on that graphic is athletic physique. It says athletic physique as a do for one of the things that you're looking for the look of a cheerleader. But the girl who's pictured on that graphic is thin. That doesn't represent many athletic physiques. Could you see how somebody could look at that who's thinking about trying out for the WSU cheer squad and they're saying, okay, it's not you we're interested in. We're not looking for you.
You know, if somebody takes away what they take away, I understand how somebody can see something and make their own decision on what they're seeing. The graphic that we sent out was merely for an aid in helping the girls and people that are trying to try out for our cheerleading squad.
Are there men on the Washington State University cheerleading squad?
Yes, we have 15 boys.
What does the graphic look like for men who want to try out for the cheer squad?
We did not make a graphic for that because I did not have access to any good photos to use that I was able to use for copyright reasons.
What are the parameters for the look for male cheerleaders at Washington State University?
Look for male cheerleaders would be very similar to the looks that we have for the girls. They need to have well-groomed facial hair or well-groomed hair, well-styled hair. They need to have an athletic physique as well. What we do is athletic. And then what they would wear for their outfits is a black t-shirt and black shorts, as well as the socks and the shoes.
How much do you think cheerleading is about looks?
Part of the reason why we have this at our tryouts is because we're going for a uniformed look on the sidelines, something that's going to be representative of WSU cheerleading, WSU athletics, and WSU. So therefore, in the world of cheerleading, part of our uniform is that look. You know, unfortunately, when you're at a football game and you're on national television, they're not always videoing you doing your skills. You know, a lot of times they're videoing the girls doing, you know, shaking the palms and cheering on the squad and whatnot. So what you're seeing at that point is what you are seeing. So you're not, you know that girls do skills, you know that they're athletic, you know, but you don't have to always be showing that all the time. So therefore, the next thing you're seeing is just the look of the squad at that point. So yeah, it is a part of our uniform and it is a part of our culture.
One of the other things that's come up, and I'm sure that you've heard about this, is that there are people who are former cheerleaders who have said, you know what, this is about athleticism. This is a sport. And seeing graphics like this kind of throws that whole notion back. It means that we're not being respected as athletes. We're not being respected for our skill. It really is about what people see when they look at us. What's your response to that?
Well, the issue is, in our world, if I say, you know, your required skills for tumbling is a standing tuck, a standing back handspring, or whatever each school might pick as their requirement, Most cheerleaders know what that is. If I say, you know, for co-ed stunting, your requirement is a toss liberty, most cheerleaders know what that is. But the people always ask, so when you say hair half up, what do you mean by that? We would like to know. We want to be best prepared. That's what led us to sending out the graphic.
Chris Opheim is the cheer squad coach at Washington State University. They're standing by their do's and don'ts on how to look at cheer squad tryouts. That's after similar advice from the University of Washington cheer squad sparked intense backlash, and the UW took that graphic down. You can check out WSU's do's and don'ts for yourself and let us know what you think. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Coming up on the record, King 5 anchor Jean Enerson steps down after 50 years and being the first female local TV news anchor in the country. That interview in 15 minutes. This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel. Tonight, when you watch the local news here in Seattle, you'll see a woman sitting in the anchor chair. But 50 years ago, that was unheard of. Until Jean Enerson became the first female local news anchor in the country. Late last month, after a 50-year career, Jean Enerson retired from King 5. But in the late 60s, when she first joined the station, the newsroom was a very different place for women. Jean Enerson told Lisa Brooks that it was kind of an old boys' club at King 5 back then.
Photographers who really didn't want to work with a female so they wouldn't get out of the car. And you just sort of play it by ear and cajole and say, well, Barney, wouldn't that be a better story if we got out of the car and shot the grain terminal at the Port of Seattle closer to it? Wouldn't that make a better story for both of us? And a photographer who wanted to go look at girls instead of shoot stories. And I said, well, okay, how about if we shoot the story first and if we have any time on the back, then we'll go look at girls. I mean, you just sort of figure out what's going to work for everybody.
Well, what was it like? Were you nervous? Were you apprehensive being the first woman doing this? Because I don't think there was another woman doing local news anywhere in the country.
Well, not anchoring is what I'm told. Was I nervous? Sure. I mean, I even to this day get a little bit nervous because I think you're up then. You're excited for what you're doing. I was actually hired to work for a documentary production company, which is my background, politics and documentary production. And about a week after I got to King, that documentary film unit closed. So here I am with all I had from college or graduate school, books and boards and bricks and, I mean, what do kids have? And nowhere to go. So kind of hung around the newsroom and said, now. And, you know, it took me a couple of tries to get hired again, and then it was sort of off and running. And just, you know, keep your head down and keep your ears open and put one foot in front of the other, and then 48 years go by.
Really? What do you think it was about you that you ended up in the anchor chair?
I really don't know. Drive, curiosity, a willingness to try it. There was an anchor man named Jim Harriet who was the sole anchor at the time that I had applied, and Jim was the most gracious, the most helpful. Jim moved over, made room for me. I listened to his voice, which was really great. I couldn't replicate the voice. I looked at how he dressed, which was sometimes polyester suits, and I couldn't do that on a regular basis. But he just advised and supported and made room for me, and we became terrific friends, and I just feel very lucky that Jim was gracious and he was such a great anchor man. And, you know, I've always had really, really wonderful partners.
You were the first local TV reporter, among the first local TV reporters that was allowed into China after the U.S. and China established diplomatic relations. I think you went in 1979.
Right.
Why did they send you?
Well, Mrs. Bullitt, the founder of our company, was always very locally involved, but very globally interested. And she sent us to China at this really important period in the Northwest development because she recognized China was going to be a huge part of our future. Now, remember, this is back in 1979, and the Cultural Revolution had happened. China was suddenly opening its doors to the West. It had been closed for decades. And we had an opportunity to go in with the first American flagship and the first U.S. airplane that was going into Beijing and into Shanghai. And we went to cover these events. But our charge given to us by her was go to China and find the truth about what? You know, that's what I said about what. And so we looked at life in the Hutongs. We looked at life on the farms. We looked at urban life. I mean, we looked at all the things that were observable. But so much in China at the time was not. So much now is not. China then, we would say now, looked quite backward compared to us. And in 40 years, you see that China is a trade partner. China is what some would call an adversary. But China is very important to our future here in the Northwest. Very important. And, of course, it's important to the entire country politically. But we're in a key position. So what did she send us for? I think she just knew it was important in our future, and it is. It's very important. I mean, I think we have a different viewpoint on the West Coast than perhaps other areas of the country do. We're a very trade-dependent part of the world, especially part of this country. And we have, as you look at the presidential race unfold, many of us have a different view here than, say, the Midwest or even the East Coast, which tends sometimes to look more towards Europe. And I think the West Coast tends sometimes to look more towards Asia.
Do you remember what any of the specific stories were when you that you told from China that you particularly connected with, that you really enjoyed?
Oh, we went to a very small town where I don't think the residents had seen people with blonde hair and white skin. And they were clearly scared. And just the reaction that we would get, people were very friendly, extremely friendly. But some were frightened because they had been told we're the white devil and what to expect. So now you think about all that we see in pictures that travel around the world instantaneously, and we know so much about each other, and we relate so closely to each other now. The time is so different.
I'd like to take it back into the anchor studio, mm-hmm. where the chair where you sat for so mm-hmm. many years. What do you think you take with you from that studio?
Some of the most significant events, I mean, for sure, OSO is one of them. I wasn't really in the studio all the time. I was at OSO, and I was really heartbroken along with the people of OSO because 43 souls were lost. Parents were looking for newborns, for infants, and to some extent felt powerless against the forces of nature, which was a giant mudslide caused by perhaps by building, perhaps by deforestation, perhaps by excessive rain up on the coast or the west side of the mountains. But we also engage in a significant effort to help the community rebuild and to at least get through this very, very hard time. It was a hard time for everybody. And I remember that most vividly, not because I was in the studio, but because I was there with people day after day and feeling the heartbreak right along with them. I also remember vividly WTO. At the time, I thought, people are tearing our city apart. And some years later now, I realize this is the beginning of a very serious protest against the dislocation that some trade pacts create for some people. And the importance of job retraining, the importance of economic restructuring so that people aren't completely dislocated, that they feel a part of the community, they feel a part of the economy, that the trade agreements that we have don't have a negative consequence for everyone, but a positive consequence for our economy and for our population.
Are you going to stay in touch with your colleagues?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're all very, very good friends, and we spent a lot of dinner hours together and a lot of dinner hours with you, with our viewers and your listeners. One of the things that I really want to impart is a tremendous gratitude I have for listeners and for viewers, because it is a partnership, and I feel very much attached to people in the community, to organizations in the community, and grateful for their support and grateful for the partnership and grateful that the things we can do together in our community. I mean, no, there are very few solo flights. Most of the great things that are done with coalitions of people, with groups of people pulling together.
Gene Enerson retired from King 5 late last month after 50 years at the station. She was the first female local TV news anchor in the country. Gene Enerson spoke with KUOW's Lisa Brooks. And this has been The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.